In realms digital and real, my influence spreads, hard to conceal. Across borders I subtly seep, war of tactics, complex and deep. Disinformation, cyber, propaganda, more. What am I? And that was this week's E-International Relations Riddle Challenge. Stay tuned to the end of this week's episode to hear the solution to this week's riddle. Hello and welcome to the Thinking Global podcast by E-International Relations. My name is Kieran O'Meara and as ever, I am your host. And this week I'm going to be joined by, well, actually it's more me doing the joining, with Tasharika Decker, my co-host, who is also an editor-at-large at E-International Relations. Hi, Tasharika.
Hi, Kieran. I hope you're doing well and good to be back.
And it's always a pleasure to have you back. Now, this week, Tasharika is in conversation with Dr. Rahul Verma on the upcoming Indian elections this year in 2024. Now, before Tasharika brings you that interview, don't forget to click on that little like, share, subscribe, or follow button. You know you want to. That way you'll be able to get all the content that Thinking Global has to offer direct to your device the moment it's uploaded. And if you're interested in the Indian elections, you might want to do that because this is the first episode in a series of episodes about the upcoming Indian elections. And we are actually going to do a little bit of political history, certainly in podcasting, because these particular episodes, some of them at least, will be multilingual, recorded in more than one language. So click on that little follow or subscribe button and you will have that come straight to your phone the moment they are uploaded. Now, as I said this week, Tasharika, you are in conversation with Dr. Rahul Verma. Rahul Verma is a fellow at the Center for Policy Research in New Delhi in India. He is also visiting assistant professor in the Department of Political Science in Ashoka University. His research interests include voting behavior, party politics, political violence, and the media. His book, co-authored with Pradeep Chibba, Ideology and Identity, The Changing Party Systems of India, by Oxford University Press from 2018, develops a new approach to defining the contours of what constitutes an ideology in multi-ethnic countries such as India. And this week, he's in conversation with our very own Tasharika Decker. Over to you, Tasharika.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Thinking Global podcast. I'm your host, Tasharika Decker. I am joined by Dr. Rahul Verma here. Hi, Rahul. Thank you so much and welcome to the podcast. It is an absolute pleasure to have you with us. We are also starting our Indian election podcast series, and this is the first episode of that. We are taking the first episode as to, you know, clear the basics related to Indian election, and not just only about forecasting, but also about to understand the current landscape, the myth and the realities and many more. So thank you again and welcome.
Thank you, Tasharika, for having me.
So my first question is, the Indian general election 2024, dates are released, and from 19 April onwards, we will see the process starting. Around 969 million people are going to exercise their right to vote, the largest in any part of the world. Could you provide our listeners with an overview of the electoral process and explain why it is conducted in phases?
Okay, thank you, Tasharika. So yes, you're right. Last week, the Election Commission of India announced a seven-phased election for 2024. The last date of polling is June 1, and the counting of votes would take place on June 4th. And the reason, so in some ways, the election process has already begun, right? Once the Election Commission announces the date of election, Model Code of Conduct comes into effect, and then the entire process of basically nomination of candidates and acceptance of their nomination and the formal campaign actually begins with the announcement of elections. So this is, in some ways, it's now like almost a 2-month affair. The reason These elections are conducted in phases. So even the last two elections, the 2014 and 2019, were seven-phased elections. And before that, some were five-phased and those kind of things. But the primary reason is actually the size of our electorate, right? Like you said, this is the largest number of voters, 969 million electors. It's not just largest, but even if you combine the entire, I would say, Western Europe and North America, the number of electors exceed, right? So it's in some ways the largest democratic exercise that takes place anywhere on this planet. Second, I think because of this mammoth size of electors, but also continental-sized polity that India is, it requires a lot of logistic arrangements in terms of moving officials, both sort of like civil officials who will conduct the elections, but also security officials moving from one place to another. Some 11 million or even more than that would be deployed as polling officials, both security and non-security combined. Thousands of trains would be used to move these officials, like millions of electronic voting machines would be used, and they would be traveling from one place or the other. So, and then the third is, of course, the security concerns in some parts of the country, and just to ensure that there is more sort of like peaceful elections and violence doesn't take place because of these security arrangements, you would see this like elections in India are conducted in multiple phases.
Right. Thank you so much for that answer. That absolutely makes sense. And thank you for giving a background to our audience. That's something was important for us to learn. Now, my next question is, and I know it's a lot to kind of unpack here, but what kind of party system does India have, and how different are the Indian general election from the rest of the world?
So these are two very different questions. And let me first answer the second question, which is how different are they? Well, of course, they are different in terms of size. But Indian elections also differ in terms of, I think it's much more colorful in comparison to many other countries of the Western world. The campaigning is much more colorful. You could also say it's much more noisy. And then the rules of the game and electoral process itself will differ from country to country, right? There are countries that use sort of like first past post the system. There are countries that use a proportional representation system to elect its members. India has first past post the system. So it depends which country you are comparing from, and then it would become much more clearer to think of like on what things and scales the Indian general elections differ. If you want to compare it from UK, like the just the population size is multiple folds different. The party system is a very sort of like not a it's a technical scholarly concept. In that sense, political scientists mainly use this to understand the emerging structure of competition, right? It's not a legal term or administrative term. And so each country at different points of time will have a different party system. And it also depends how you want to define party system. Do you want to define it in terms of effective number of parties? Do you want to define it in terms of ideological orientation of the party system or sociological orientation of the party system? Generally, the way political scientists, and it's much easier to understand, is to see whether it's a like two-party system or multi-party system and those kind of things. So in India, you have like hundreds of parties that compete in a general election. Last in 2019, you had more than 600 parties that competed. Some 36 parties got one or two, like 36 parties at least got representation in parliament, and most of these parties had just one or two members. So largely, like six or seven players who will get a large number of seats. So in India, because you have lots of parties, like some six or seven parties who are nationally recognized parties, meaning that they are present in more than three, four states. Then you have lots of state-level formations that contest and win elections only in a particular territory or geography. And then you have lots of parties which are very, very local in that sense. So India currently, by scholarly consensus, is in what we call as fourth party system. And so from independence till 67, we had first party system, which was Congress dominant between 67 and 1989. Congress was still dominant at the national level, but it had started weakening at the state level. So by, like some sort of opposition had begun to the Congress system. The third party system between 89 and 2014 is basically a coalitional governments came to force. So it was a multi-party system. While we still have multiple parties competing and winning election, it seems like we are in a fourth party system where BJP is a dominant force nationally. They lose elections at the state level, but in national elections, their main competitor, Congress, is far behind them in both seats and vote share.
Thank you so much for giving that background. And now that you started about the BJP and the Congress, for those who are unfamiliar with the Indian politics, how would you describe the BJP as a political party? Do they currently hold a broad mandate, and which we know they do? Could you provide some insight into the prominent party members beyond the Prime Minister Modi?
Okay, so let's start again with the last part of the question. At the moment, you know, like Prime Minister Modi is at the helm of the affairs, so he would be certainly the most known name. Then within the BJP, Home Minister Amit Shah would be an important person. Defense Minister Rajnath Singh, who was earlier party president. The current party president is JP Nadda. Then you have many important sort of like chief ministers, leaders of the state. So Yogi Adityanath in Uttar Pradesh, Himanta Biswa Sarma in Assam, the outgoing chief minister of Madhya Pradesh, Shivraj Singh Chauhan, you know, some other popular names you could think of, Smriti Irani, who's union minister, former external affairs minister who, you know, like Sushma Swaraj was very important, Lal Krishna Advani, former prime minister, you know, Atal Bihari Vajpayee, former chief minister of Rajasthan, Vasundhara Raje Sindhya. So there are lots of leaders. It's a big national party. And depending upon like which kind of leadership you are looking for, one can go into more detail. BJP, you know, it, like if you want to talk in sort of like ideological terms and you want to use the labels that has been developed in Western Europe and North America, BJP in that sense would be a center-right party. Some would also call it an ultra-nationalist party or Hindu nationalist party. But broadly, like BJP has grown both in its sort of like geographical reach as well as in its social base that it draws from. So geographically, if you think of like early 90s or early 2000s, BJP was largely a party which had presence in northwestern India, and it would be described as a party more resonating with urban, middle class and upper segments of the society. That has changed quite dramatically in last 10 years. It's sort of like geographical reach has expanded. So now the party is running government in many parts of the eastern India and northeast. It's still like southern states, especially Tamil Nadu and Kerala, BJP's presence is weaker, for that matter, even Andhra Pradesh. But in Karnataka, they recently had formed government. They won some seats in southern state of Telangana. But broadly, you could say that BJP is much more stronger in northwest and comparatively weaker on the you know, like Bay of Bengal coastline. In terms of social base, BJP gets very few votes from religious minorities, Muslims and Christians included. But within the Hindu sort of like fold, BJP has become much more broad-based than it was. Of course, it draws more votes from the upper segments than the lower segments of Hindu society. but it has expanded multiple fold in last 10 years. Just to give you an example, among scheduled caste or Dalits, BJP's vote share till 2009 used to be just 10 to 12 percentage point, which increased to 24 in 2014 and 33 plus in 2019, right? So massive increases happening in the sort of like lower segments of the society. It has also managed to get serious inroads in the rural segments of India's population.
Thank you for that answer, Rahul, and thank you for giving us a breakup of how the BJP is faring across India. And to add to that, I think I'm from the Northeast, and we definitely see this growth of the BJP in Northeast. I think one of the interesting reason is also because a lot of the Congress party leaders have moved to the BJP, which is kind of interesting. And I think a lot of listeners would not internationally know that it's very common for politician in India to move parties. Okay, now the next thing is about the Congress, and which I think you would be, kind of, it'll give them a better background to understand. Could you please provide some insight into the Congress party, serving as the opposition to the BJP? What are the fundamental political principles that underpin the Congress party? And I know obviously there's a lot more to that that has been changing in the last few years, but if you could briefly give us some background.
Okay, so Congress is a very old political formation in India, right? It was formed in some ways in 1885 when we had British colonialism in the country. But the Congress, we are actually, and the party has governed India for a long period of time after independence. Congress was actually the dominant political formation at the time of independence in 1947. And they had been in power, one would say, for more than 50, 55 years in the last 75 years of Indian independence. So in some ways, the story of India post-independence is also a story of like how Congress has grown or declined and those kind of things. But when we are talking about the Congress at present day, I would say this Congress party was formed or at least became active in 1978 post-emergency when Mrs. Indira Gandhi moved out or was sort of like shown doors of the original Congress party. It also had happened in 1969. So let's not get into that history, but we are talking about the Congress party, which is basically in some ways the helm of affairs had always been with the Gandhi family in last 50 years, barring few years after the death of Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi or assassination of Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi during the 1991 election campaign. And so this party like before BJP came to power in 2014, the Congress party was part of a coalition government that governed India between 2004 and 14. So the Congress was the largest unit of that coalition. And as I said, like before 1989 or even 1996, Congress was largely the biggest national party. So what we are seeing in electoral terms are decline in the strength of the Congress party, and it's shrinking in size, both in terms of vote share and seat share. To my mind, the problem that Congress party faces at the moment are multifaceted. It's not like one thing, as if like they have been weakened organizationally, or there is ideological incoherence within the party, or the leadership is not as charismatic as it earlier used to be. I think Congress at this juncture faces all kinds of problem. And so in last two elections, in 2014 and 2019, Congress had a really tough time. Their vote share came below 20% nationally, and the seat share was like 44 in 2014 and 52 in 2019. So it's like a poor shadow of its former self, not just in electoral terms, but its ability to mobilize a large segment of Indians has also gone down. So it's shrinking in size. And And that's why it also becomes difficult at this point to answer your question on what fundamental political principles underpin the Congress Party, because while different leaders of the Congress Party will prioritize different principles, there is no coherent element to Congress politics at this point of time. But if you want to just broadly know this, Congress will argue that it is an umbrella tent, tries to represent all sections of the society. You could describe it as like broadly a center-left formation. That would be my take on that.
Welcome to this Thinking Global podcast episode's intermission. Now, if you're a frequent listener, you'll know that I love the intermissions because I get to read out some of your letters and comments. Now, this week, we didn't get that many letters through. We did get a few. And we would just like to take the week to say thank you to everybody that writes in that doesn't actually get anything read out on the podcast. There are so many of you, and we'd like to read out every single letter, but we just don't have the space and time to do so. Thank you so much for writing in, though. Please keep writing in. We love hearing your thoughts, what you're publishing on, where you're studying, what you're studying at the moment, and what parts of the international relations you have enjoyed reading or listening to. Please send your letters to thinkingglobal.eir@gmail.com. There will be a link in the description box. Now, this week's open letter competition. To what extent has the post-Cold War liberal order been successful? If you can answer that question, to what extent has the post-Cold War liberal order been successful, and write a 300-word letter reply to that question, our favourite entry will be read out on next week's podcast episode. Just email your answers to thinkingglobal.eir@gmail.com. And don't forget to go over to International Relations if you haven't done so already. There you'll be able to find just loads, tons of free books. Free books. Yes, you heard me right. That was not a figment of your imagination. I said there are free books out there on International Relations. Loads of daily articles, reviews, features, interviews, just loads of content for you to go and check out. So go check out e-ir.info now. International Relations is also on social media, on TikTok, on Instagram, on LinkedIn, on Facebook, and on X, formerly Twitter. Just go find us at e_ir, e-ir. You'll be able to find us. Just type in e-international relations and you'll find us on social media. There's loads of extra content, loads of riddle challenges, and we post those open letter competitions where the winner gets read out on the podcast episodes on social media before we read them out here. So go over there and check it out if you want your letters and your thoughts read out on this podcast. Alongside that, please don't forget that at International Relations, all the content that you hear, you read, you watch, all of it is produced by volunteers. International Relations is a not-for-profit periodical and open access website. As a result of that, loads of work goes in time dedicated by recruits, like myself. So, if you enjoy the content and the output of the International Relations, please consider a donation so that we can keep it going. There is a link to that in the description box. Okay, let's get back to Tusharika and Rahul Verma.
It's interesting to see how the party has also changed in the last so many decades. So moving on, and this is something I think I'm interested particularly. What about the regional parties? And how does the presence of a strong regional party impact the election? What actually is the role of a regional party?
Okay, so let me make a distinction between... So I generally don't like to use the term regional party. I basically, because there are two kinds of regional parties. One regional party is which is basically present in a given territory, right? It does not cross the state boundary. That's one kind of regional party. The second kind of regional party is that uses regional sentiments to mobilize, right? So these are two very different, like Samajwadi Party is a very different kind in Uttar Pradesh, is a very different kind of regional party than, say, DMK in Tamil Nadu, because DMK uses Tamil sentiments or has used Tamil sentiments to mobilize voters. Now, in some parts of the country, these state-level formations or regional parties continue to be very, very strong, right? Like in Tamil Nadu or in Andhra Pradesh or in right? And in many parts of East and Northeast, you have these regional formations which continue to be very, very strong. And national parties like Congress and BJP are very weak there. In Tamil Nadu, like it's, the politics has been at for last 3 decades or more has been between DMK and AIDMK. In West Bengal, TMC has been in now power for more than 10, 12 years. Before that, it was CPIM. Of course, CPIM has presence in multiple states, but like for practical purposes, it was just 3 states. In Odisha, you have BJD, which has been in power for 25 odd years. In Andhra Pradesh, you have YSRCP, and the contest is going to be between YSRCP and TDP. In many parts of Northeast, you have the National People's Party, and in Manipur and in other places, you have lots of these regional formations, and they continue to remain strong. And most likely, some of them are also going to hold their fort. They wouldn't allow BJP or Congress to win a lot of seats in their area. But if you ask just about 2024 election, the main competition or the way elections are going to be decided depends on how Congress performs vis-a-vis BJP in the northwestern geography of India. Because if BJP sweeps this part as it did in 2014 and 2019, then they would already be in striking distance of power. So it wouldn't matter if BJP wins a seat in Tamil Nadu or not, if it continues to win 90 or 95% of the seats in northwestern India.
Thank you so much for breaking down that for us, Rahul. And it would be interesting to see and how things turn out. And I wanted to understand one more thing, and kind of considering that technology is something that we all are talking about at the moment, and your own work have also touched upon that, and many other scholars. So how has this media exposure and voting behavior has impacted voting in India? So how does social media impact voting patterns, and how should we expect such digital impact to manifest in the upcoming elections?
So let me first, break down this idea. So if you look at survey data and try to look at people who are more media exposed and who do they vote for. So I'm talking more in terms of correlations rather than causal term. They're more likely to vote for BJP, not just now, but even in the past. Right? And that's the same pattern you would see for social media exposure as well. There is a demographic reason for why you would see this. So penetration of media in itself follows some demographic logic, right? It would be much more used or present in urban area, would be much more used by those who have sort of like college education, come from middle classes. Because in India there is also caste class overlap, so those who are from upper caste and men, right? So that's the demographic pattern in which traditional media penetration has happened and also social media penetration has happened. BJP traditionally has been party of this upper segment of the society, right? So the correlation that you see between media exposure or social media exposure and BJP vote for last 2 decades is largely a fact of like demographic penetration of media and social media. Point two on this is somehow BJP has also been much more agile to adapt to technology and online presence compared to Congress, right? So if you see like the gap between the number of followers the BJP social media handles have and Congress have is huge. Forget about the gap between like Prime Minister Modi and Rahul Gandhi, right? So BJP was much more agile and first mover to adapt to some of these mediums, And so it's paying dividend for them, right? So they're not just there on ground and sort of like offline infrastructure is much better for mobilization. Their online infrastructure is much, much better than any other party in the country. This is not to say that media presence alone in India can win you elections, right? It may help you on the margins, but still much of the campaigning in India happens on ground. I think the usage of social media or technology is just to amplify that message and perhaps target this urban middle class, young, upper caste kind of a voting demography. To your final sort of like thing, which is like what kind of impacts it is having. See, technology is playing a great role in elections everywhere. But technology, again, remains just a medium, right? It's a catalyst to be able to send out your messages to your constituents very sort of at a high frequency. But and so what we have seen in the last 10 years, that technology has been adopted by various parties and politicians in varying degree. BJP has been more adept to it. So you would see like prime ministers for like Modi when he was not even prime minister as a BJP campaign chief, his holograms were basically used for all kinds of talking. BJP's online media infrastructure is very robust and it's like, you know, try to create all kinds of messages, both positive and negative, to generate some attention for them. And so in that sense, they are slightly ahead or seriously ahead in terms of online infrastructure compared to any other party.
Thank you so much for that answer, Rahul. We're almost coming towards the end of the interview, but there are two questions that I have in my mind. And although it might be too early to ask this question, how do you think the upcoming Indian elections may potentially affect the regional and international order? And I know that you strongly believe in forecasting, so I think you're the right person to ask this. And there's one question that we ask all our speakers, and that is that, what is it to think globally for you to mean?
Okay, so let me, you know, like forecasting is human. You know, everybody loves to forecast. Some people would put their neck on in front of everyone, and other people also, you know, like at least in their head, they forecast, or their sort of like more closed door forecasting. Because the reason why I said forecasting is human, not just about elections, but we want to know a little bit about future, right? We make investment decisions or saving decisions. So like everything around us we do is also guided by what we think will happen in future. So that's why, like, you know, it's not any different from anyone. I study elections and voting behavior, so I do this as also part of my bread and butter. But forecasting becomes, of course, easier when you have more data points and signals to see what's happening. The problem with like how general public understands with forecasting is that, oh, you said X number of seats, but it was either X minus or X plus. Actually, if you know a little bit of science of forecasting is about modeling uncertainty, not making on dot predictions, right? So like forecasting for me is, given what I know, what is the range in which I will see the future, say 5 months onward or 6 months onward? So from that perspective, all polls are converging towards a comfortable BJP lead, right? Now, BJP lead could be like just 250, 270, so far ahead of the opposition, to what Prime Minister Modi has said in the parliament that we'll win 370 alone, or our alliance is going to cross 400. Now, where it would actually stop, there are a lot of things still happening, right? Like all parties are still forming alliances. All candidates have still not been announced. So to be able to say at what number BJP is going to stop, that's hard. But to my mind, if BJP had 303 seats in the last election, I don't think now there is any time left for anything dramatic to happen. So I don't even want to add any caveats. But BJP is roughly going to be around same number, 15, 20 seats here and there, right? That's the high likelihood of happening. Is it impossible for them to get below 250 or cross 340? No, I wouldn't say it's impossible, but it's low probability area. So that's how I think about probabilities. Now, coming to your questions on, like thinking global and regional international order, both of these questions in some ways are connected, right? Thinking global means that you are not, in a very sort of like basic sense, not driven by your own parochial concerns of like just your identity, whether it's sort of like regional identity, caste, or your religious identity, or your own country, but think largely about human civilization as whole, and think in terms that we all are connected in some way. And if there are bad things that are going to happen, such as like climate change, then it is going to adversely affect everyone. And if there is going to be economic growth at some point, it's going to help everyone, right? So just from that perspective is that we all are connected. And in some ways, everyone should be meaningfully contributing so that life of a larger section of society becomes, or humans race becomes better. And when I'm like thinking of human, I'm not excluding all other life forms, but that's the broad idea. Now, when you think of international order, you can think of international order in terms of being connected and trying to do good things for everyone. You can also think of international order in terms of power politics, right? Will there be like, will it be governed by one power or multiple powers and those kind of things? So at the moment, like global order is in flux. That means even the international, regional international order is in flux. And India in last 5 years or 7 years has been trying to take advantage for itself to get some share of recognition and sort of like some more power for itself globally as well as in the regional space. So you would see like India or at least BJP and Prime Minister Modi making a lot of deal about like hosting G20 presidential summit in country last year, right? And you would see a lot of Indians actually buying into this idea that India's image is increasing or rising globally. This is one of the planks on which BJP is mobilizing certain segments of population. And so if the forecast is that BJP is likely to get the third term and Prime Minister Modi is going to be at the helm of affairs, we are likely to see a much more continuity on what was going on in last 5, 7 years. And I would say this continuous process is also part of like previous regimes. At least on the foreign policy concerns, there is much more continuity in India than anyone would like to believe. But I also know, and I know most people would understand this, is that like flexing your muscles is not the right way to gain strength in regional international order without having substance to it. And so unless India can move from a low-income country to a middle-income country to a high-income country, and whatever that brackets might be, unless you have that economic muscle or economic power, your ability to shape any kind of international order remains a pipe dream, right? And so it's like, and I hope if Prime Minister Modi and BJP comes to power, or anyone else comes to power, we have the right economic agenda that takes India forward in that direction. And this is not to basically establish power or hegemony, but to be able to move out a lot of people from poverty and inequality for a better life, and hopefully like help not just Indians but everyone across the globe, the way we were actually at the forefront to help people during the COVID, right? So what government of India said as COVID vaccination program and trying to send vaccines to many parts of the world. So I think that is how we should be thinking about influencing or having an influence in regional, international order, and even global order.
Thank you so much, Rahul. That is fantastic. And I kind of feel that you've just opened a Pandora's box for us. I think there are way more questions now I want to ask, but we are short on time and I know you're very busy and I would not keep you waiting. But then I think as we go along with the series that you've started, and also as we go along the election process, we would be trying to address more answer to the questions that we have. And I hope our listeners could, you know, enjoy more about it and we can have more people working around the field can come and speak to us. So thank you so much for joining us for our first series on Indian elections 2024. I really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Tusharika. Thank you for having me.
Wow. Well, I can honestly say that because 40 minutes ago, I knew absolutely nothing about the Indian electoral system. I feel like I've just had a crash course in it. So thank you so much, Dr. Rahul Verma, for that. Absolutely fantastic. And thank you so much to Sharika for organizing this particular interview and for heading up this series, which is going to be absolutely amazing. So I'd like to take this time before we get to the solution of this week's riddle to thank the eInternational Relations podcast team. You guys are magnificent. You are amazing. And this just would not work without your hard, hard work. So thank you ever so much to Victoria H. Bergstrom, Edward Curry, Catherine Dameron, Jennifer Engel, Nigel Huckle, Daniel McDade, Eduardo Pieroni, and Romanos Orfeas Toffis. You guys rule. You are awesome. And thanks also to Material Music for doing the music. Also, don't forget to go check out eInternational Relations at e-ir.info. Go check us out on social media, on Facebook, on TikTok, on Instagram, on LinkedIn, and of course, X, formerly Twitter. It will forever be formerly Twitter for me. Also, please do send us your letters to thinkingglobal.eir@gmail.com. There will be a link in the description box or on the website, the article for this episode. You will see the email at the bottom of the page. For the last time, please, please click on that little like, share, subscribe, or follow button, especially if you want to keep up to date with everything about the Indian elections and this brilliant series that Tusharika has for you. That is also multilingual. Yes, we cannot wait for this. I am so pumped for it. Okay, let's get to that riddle. This week's riddle was: in realms digital and real, my influence spreads, hard to conceal. Across borders, I subtly seep. War of tactics, complex and deep. Disinformation, cyber, propaganda, more. What am I? And the answer was hybrid warfare. And that was a deliberately really, really, really difficult one. And it was so difficult that actually nobody got it on any of our social media platforms. So yeah, keep going. Maybe next week someone will win the shout out, and stay tuned for another riddle challenge. And thank you so, so much to Tusharika Decker for this week's episode. I guess that's everything for this week, so I suppose there's only one last thing left to say. I've been Kieran O'Meara.
I'm Tusharika Dekar.
And together we've been Thinking Global.